Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Last week, amid brutal election violence, Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe effectively made himself president for life of his southern African nation. This week, thumbing his nose at African Union leaders, he told critics to stay out of it. Once a liberation hero who triumphed over white rule, Mugabe has become a world-class dictator. Now, with Zimbabwe at a crisis point, he's defying the world. This hour on Point, Robert Mugabe and Zimbabwe in the balance. Joining me first from Johannesburg, South Africa, is Euphebia Quist-Arkton, NPR foreign correspondent. She's been closely following the politics of Zimbabwe and the region. Euphebia, welcome to On Point.
Greetings.
Give us a sense of what's going on there, Euphebia. What are the headlines in Africa today?
Post the African Union summit in Egypt, which ended yesterday, and called for a national unity government, a coalition government between President Robert Mugabe and the opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, everybody's waiting to see what both sides say. It looks as if the opposition, which won the first round of the presidential vote and the parliamentary election, is saying, as things stand, it doesn't quite agree with this proposal from the African Union. So we'll have to see whether dialogue and reconciliation is really the way forward in Zimbabwe after all the violence and turmoil.
How was Mugabe welcomed at the African Union meeting this week? Are African leaders in any way losing patience with him?
Certainly some. There was a clear division between the African leaders who wanted to isolate Robert Mugabe and those who, if not wanting to embrace him, at least wanted to keep him in the fold. Botswana, for example, one of Zimbabwe's neighbors, actually suggested that Mugabe be suspended from the African Union and from the Southern African Development Community. And there are lots of people saying that the regional mediator, South Africa's president, Thabo Mbeki, is too soft in his diplomacy and that it hasn't worked and he needs to toughen that stance. The opposition movement for democratic change of Morgan Tsvangirai is saying that they should widen the mediation, that there should be a permanent envoy in Zimbabwe who day-to-day deals with trying to end the crisis.
Where is opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai now?
He is back home in his home in Zimbabwe. As you know, about 10 days ago, he took refuge in the Dutch embassy in Harare, fearing not only for his safety, but saying that the violence against his supporters must end. But it seems now that the violence has gone down a bit since the actual vote and the very hasty swearing-in of Robert Mugabe as president for a sixth term on Sunday. But there's still a hiatus, let me say, in Zimbabwe. And, of course, there's still the economic crisis that went along with this political and electoral crisis.
Mugabe told his Western critics this week to, quote, go hang 1,000 times. Where does the United States stand on this issue right now?
Well, it was actually his spokesman, George Charamba, who said that the West must stop. But he's repeating what his boss says, that Washington and the former colonial power Britain must stop meddling in the internal affairs of Zimbabwe. Washington has been very clear. President Bush, the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, have said that this is a rogue regime, that the election was a sham, and that Mugabe should not be recognized. But, of course, that has not happened amongst his peers in Africa. But Africa has to deal with this crisis. A lot of people are saying it's all well and good for the West and the UN and others to say what they like about Zimbabwe, but we are their we are Zimbabwe's neighbors. We have to deal with the millions of Zimbabweans that are flooding out of the country because of the political crisis, the economic crisis, and, of course, more recently, the violence.
Euphebia Quist-Arkton is NPR foreign correspondent. She joins me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Euphebia, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
Joining me now from Washington is Steve Morrison, director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He is a former Africa policymaker in the Clinton administration. Steve, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jane.
And joining me from Brussels, Belgium, is Promise Mukwananzi. He is the former president of the Zimbabwe National Students Union. He was arrested many times and was finally forced to flee the country late last year. He's now part of the Global Zimbabwe Forum, an exiles group that supports the opposition leadership headed by Morgan Tsvangirai. Promise, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to start with you, Promise, and I'd like you to tell us what the circumstances were when you left Zimbabwe last year.
The circumstances were extremely difficult. I think the government had already started, you know, to go on a rampage, which has been going on since 2000. And at the time when I was leader of students in the country, the crisis and the repression of the people was ever escalating. I mean, myself, I was in and out of prison for more than 18 times. Many more people were killed without the publicity, which the issue is now getting now, which I should say is very good as well.
You were in and out of prison 18 times, you say. How were you treated when you were arrested and in detention?
Despite the fact that I had been arrested for no crime at all, I was treated like a criminal. The beatings, the denigrations, and general harassment by police officers, and the allowing of the youth militia to intervene in matters which should have been involving the police, you know, for the law to take its own course. It's a tradition within the Mugabe regime to treat political prisoners as criminals and to harass them, intimidate them, and try to cow them into submission.
You have left. I know so many others have as well. Is there any organized opposition really left now in Zimbabwe?
Certainly. The election of the 29th of March reflect the existence of a very formidable and robust opposition in the country, and it also shows that given a free and fair environment, that opposition would easily come into power. This is because of a combination of factors: the misgovernance, the failure of leadership by the Mugabe regime, the failure of the economy at the hands of the Mugabe regime, and the general discontent within the people of Zimbabwe in terms of what they would want to see Zimbabwe become, and also the organizational institutions of the oppositions, which have gained a lot of experience over the years, show that there is indeed a very strong opposition, especially in light of the repression and the spirited attempt by the ruling party to completely decimate those structures.
You talked a little bit about how you were treated in detention when you were under arrest. I wonder how bad conditions are generally speaking. I read numbers: 80% of Zimbabweans now live in poverty. A quarter of the population of the 12 million people in Zimbabwe have fled to other countries. Can you describe what your people generally are living through right now?
Considering the fact that Zimbabwe has not been at a full-scale war, I don't know whether it is still true, but previously the situation was the worst in the world in a country which is outside a full-scale war. But now I think the situation is increasingly turning itself into a full-scale war, so things are getting even worse than what they've been.
Steve Morrison, why do you think African leaders, generally speaking, have been so reluctant to criticize Robert Mugabe?
Well, there are many different African leaders with many different viewpoints and reasons for that. I mean, in the Southern African leadership, I think they have been resistant to take until recently to taking on Mugabe, partly out of solidarity. He's an icon. He's a figure of liberation struggle era. SADC itself, the Southern African Development Community, has been internally divided and unable to come forward with with a very coherent approach, and those who have been critics have tended to be somewhat quiet in deference to the to try to preserve some semblance of unity. That's beginning to break down right now, and so you see Botswana, Zambia, Tanzania, and the southern African states stepping forward and being quite critical. You see the Nigerians stepping forward and saying some very critical things, and other leaders. The African Union was formed recently, earlier in this decade, as a successor to the Organization of African Unity. It was meant to change the norms and of that body and move it towards much more peer review and self-criticism and attention to human rights and democratic process. The OAU was seen as basically a dictator's club that would not tread on each other's interests. It's been slow to sort of the AU process has been somewhat slow to sort of move forward and take on Zimbabwe, but that is changing with the AU's position that was taken in Cairo this week.
You talk about some of the regional leaders referring to Mugabe as an icon. Nelson Mandela referred to Mugabe as a tragic figure in leadership.
Right.
What are the regional implications if this situation continues, Steve Morrison? I got about 30 seconds left of the break.
The regional implications for this crisis are huge. You could see retribution violence internally that will continue to put a spotlight on what's happening. You could see an additional outflow of desperate refugees into the region. There's already over 3 million in South Africa and Botswana, and there's been strong reaction against the presence of those populations in those countries. You could see that aggravated. You could see the economic decline continue, particularly as the mining sector continues to deteriorate, which the mining sector is the only sector that continues to function within Zimbabwe.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about Zimbabwe's sham election and the implications for Africa generally. On Sunday, June 29th, at the presidential residence, Robert Mugabe was sworn in for his sixth term as president of Zimbabwe.
I, Robert Gabriel Mugabe, do swear that I will well and truly serve Zimbabwe in the office of President. So help me God.
After Mugabe claimed victory on Sunday, Morgan Tsvangirai, leader of Zimbabwe's opposition party, considered the future of Mugabe's presidency. Tsvangirai pulled out of the runoff election against President Mugabe in an effort to protect his supporters from election violence.
As far as we are concerned, the world and the African Union is building up, the pressure is building up against him. And so as far as we're concerned, we are nearer the solution than we have ever been. Because as far as where does he go from here?
Let's bring back our guests into our conversation. We're speaking this hour with Steve Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Promise Mukwananzi, former head of the Zimbabwe National Students Union and an exiled activist. I also like to bring into the conversation now another voice from Cape Town, Africa, Heidi Holland. She's a longtime journalist and an author. She grew up in Zimbabwe, and she's an expert of sorts on Robert Mugabe, and she was granted a rare interview with him last year. Her new book is called Dinner with Mugabe, The Untold Story of a Freedom Fighter Who Became a Tyrant. Heidi, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane.
Tell us about your most recent meetings with Mugabe, the dictator Mugabe.
Yes, I met him just before Christmas last year, 6 months ago, having met him previously 30 years before when he was a freedom fighter, the same man, basically, very shy, actually, you'd be surprised to hear, quietly spoken when he's not on the campaign trail, a rather terrifying man in the sense that he wears absolutely no expression on his face, I think as a technique to disconcert you. He once told his niece, who I interviewed, that you must never betray your feelings. People mustn't know what you're thinking. So a very cold, calculating man.
How was he different than when you interviewed him 30 years ago, Heidi?
Well, I could see he was the same man. As I say, He was quiet and very watchful. He's a very distilled man. There's nothing superfluous in him, you know. He had a troubled childhood, a very emotionally deprived childhood, and as a result, he shut down on his emotions, became highly developed intellectually. He's got 7 degrees, and very underdeveloped emotionally. I mean, highly developed intellectually. To a ludicrous extent.
Ludicrous extent. So this is a shrewd and calculating man? This is not a crazy man?
I don't think he's crazy as such. I mean, he's not clinically mad, but he's arranged himself now over the last, I don't know how many years, probably the last decade, in a reality bubble where he can only be right, he can't be wrong. He surrounds himself with people who endorse everything he says, completely intolerant of criticism. I had to contradict him several times, as you can imagine. I was there for 2.5 hours. And whenever I contradicted what he said, sparks would fly into his eyes. You could actually physically see his anger in his eyes, in this impassive face. I think the reason he's arranged himself in this denial is because he can't face what he's done there. I don't think it's because he's mad as such, but of course there comes a time when you're so out of touch with reality, and he is deluded, there's no doubt about that, that you might as well be mad. I mean, I prefer to think of him as living in the world in a mad sort of way.
You've written about the banner that hangs outside Mugabe's office, which reads, "Mugabe is right." Why is it important to understand Mugabe's background and his love-hate relationship with the British and really with white Zimbabweans to understand how he's reacting today?
You know, Mugabe is a very, very complicated person. Like so many, especially in southern Africa, but all over the continent, he's very damaged because of the history, the colonial history. Don't forget he's an 84-year-old man. He actually embodies colonialism, British colonialism. He grew up in a mission station. His surrogate father was a white priest. He wasn't allowed to visit what he calls his heathen granny without the permission of the white priest. So that's how the missionaries operated back then, you know, all of which is very problematic in terms of his identity. And so Mugabe grew up identifying more with the British, and that's partly an inferiority complex of note, of course, which is why when he talked about the British royal family, his eyes glistened with tears.
Yes, he speaks with love almost for them.
Yes. Well, no, I think that's genuine, because, as I say, I think that's who he identifies with. And so he's very aggrieved. He's aggrieved about almost everything because, as I say, being emotionally weak, he can't take responsibility for anything at all. And so, I don't, you know, of course, many people will argue, well, who cares what Mugabe thinks or how he functions, he must go. Well, of course, this is true. But we've manifestly failed to get rid of him. And that's partly because he's a strategist of note. And he really does run rings around all of us, really.
You describe him, Heidi, as an aggrieved man, and you warn against the United States and Britain and others. You warn against boxing him into a corner. You know him. You have met him face to face. What is the best way to handle Robert Mugabe?
Well, I know it's controversial, but I think the Western world in particular should talk to him. I don't think Africa's going to solve this problem. I think Africa's out of time because I very much fear that the violence is going to continue in the rural areas where it's less visible than in the towns. Because Mugabe he's going for revenge. I mean, he has won and he's back for 5 years, but he's a very vindictive man. He can't forgive, and I think he's consumed now by this anger. You saw recently, he just flew off the handle with, I think it was a CNN journalist, and you got this glimpse of a man absolutely seething. Well, of course, this is the man I've been describing for the last 6 months, but generally he can keep a lid on it, and that was just a little glimpse of how angry he is. I think he's bottled up his emotions lifelong, because as I say, you know, when he was a child, he had no friends, he was just this little lonely boy. He told me he used to like to talk to himself. He didn't need friends. He used to recite little poems. And partly that was he cut himself off from his feelings because life was too painful for him. And this has become a lifelong pattern. So he's got this sort of festering wound inside him, which we now see exploding. So, I mean, I think at our peril do we continue to humiliate Mugabe. He can't take it. And although, you know, I mean, there are world standards of how people should operate, and I'm not undermining any of that, and I'm no apologist for Mugabe. But I think there comes a point when one has to be pragmatic, especially in the interests of the Zimbabweans who are going to die.
Promise Mukwananzi, does this sound like the dictator that you know, the man who has exacted terrible violence and revenge on his people? Sounds like an accurate description to you?
Yeah, obviously it borders around what we have heard about his history, which the government has tried to keep very, very secretive. But certainly, yes, the isolated childhood, the secretive Mugabe is what we have known, and very, very vindictive against those who have wronged him in the past, and not very well known for forgiving or for tolerating divergent views. It is exactly a summation of the impression which Zimbabweans have about him.
Promise, do you think more sanctions against Zimbabwe would only hurt the people there, or do you think that they would have some impact?
Well, it depends. I think it's a very complex situation which has been giving a lot of people headache. But I think that as much as Mugabe is refusing to cede, so shall the international community react. There is need to tighten up the screws as much as possible, seeing also that that is the only way which the international community can effectively, you know, compel Mugabe to come back to the round table and begin to speak with the opposition and begin to embrace democratic principles, respect the election outcome, and retain the rule of law. But I would emphasize that whatever form of sanctions which should be put on Mugabe, every effort must be made to cushion the vulnerable and innocent people of Zimbabwe from any negative impact. So things which deal with the restrictions of ammunition for the Mugabe regime to continue the violation of people's rights would be very ideal.
Steve Morrison, Robert Mugabe is 84 years old now. Does he have a successor? Who's in line?
It's not at all clear who is in line. I mean, you can make an argument that Morgan Tsvangirai is the legitimate heir to power on the basis of the March elections.
The opposition leader, Tsvangirai.
The opposition leader. I think the important point to make here is not to dwell on the emotional complexities of Mugabe or try how do we avoid hurting his feelings. I think we need to make the point here that Zimbabweans have been abandoned in this period and subjected to horrible mistreatment at the hands of a tyrant and a series of security agencies that have been able to operate with impunity. And we need to move to the, we need some sort of concerted international diplomatic effort that involves both African leadership and non-African leadership to move Zimbabwe into some sort of post-Mugabe future. And it's likely that the government of national unity option is not going to be feasible. It's likely that ultimately Zimbabwe in this next phase is going to go through more difficulty with escalating violence, with further economic decline, further refugee flows. But I believe that ultimately we're going to move to a discussion around transitional arrangements in which Mugabe will move on in some fashion, and there will be some sort of negotiated set of arrangements that will restore constitutional rule, move towards some sort of interim arrangements in future elections, and have to provide some measure of security against arbitrary violence at the hands of the inner circle of the bitter enders around Mugabe.
Let's go to the phones now and welcome some of our listeners into the conversation. First from Newton, Massachusetts, Tawanda is on the line. Tawanda, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I'm really appalled by what's going on in Zimbabwe. I'm a Zimbabwean. I grew up in Zimbabwe and moved to the U.S. about 8 years ago. And it's just a shame, you know, seeing all the African leaders, you know, sitting there with Mugabe. And it just shows what Africa is all about. A bunch of leaders that get into power and they know each other, and that once you're in power, you can do whatever you want. The thing that really appalls me is the fact that the U.S. could go into Iraq and take care of issues there, and now Mugabe is trying to use the fact that if Britain tries to intervene with what's going on in Zimbabwe, it's colonialism all over again. And it's not that. I mean, the world should not sit there and watch this. I mean, people are dying. This is going to become another Rwanda. I mean, I don't know what the world is, how long the world is going to wait before they can intervene, because this is a really bad situation in Zimbabwe, you know.
Tawanda, thank you. Heidi Holland, do you hear what Tawanda is saying? I mean, should the U.S. not be afraid to intervene here? And is it inevitable that the end game for Mugabe is volatile and potentially very dangerous?
Yes, I think that definitely the initiative needs to shift it quite soon, especially if there's ongoing violence, as I fear there might be and probably will be in the rural areas as Mugabe gets revenge. I think that absolutely every avenue should be explored. And what I'm advocating is what one might call psychodiplomacy, to find out who one's dealing with and find out what's possible with his cooperation. Because I don't think we can afford to wait for some later time when Mugabe, I mean, he'll eventually drop dead. But you know what? His mother died when she was nearly 100 and he's 84. So I don't think we can rely on this being an old man who's going to run his course. Of course he will. And I don't think we can rely on the situation not getting worse. I think that Western diplomacy has relied on both those, or certainly on the situation not getting worse. And it's got worse and worse and worse. The sanctions are not effective. They prop up Mugabe's propaganda machine. Mm. So, you know, I don't think I'd take Stephen's point that one doesn't want, you know, it's pointless worrying about his feelings, and I did preface what I was saying, that people do regard it possibly as an immoral position that one treats Mugabe with any sort of respect. But the fact is, this is what he wants, and it might be possible to move things along by talking to him.
Heidi Holland has been joining us from Cape Town, Africa. Heidi, I appreciate your tremendous insight today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Heidi Holland is a journalist and author of Dinner with Mugabe, the untold story of a freedom fighter who became a tyrant. Before we go to the break, Promise Mukwananzi, does your exile group want to see a unity government with Mugabe and Tsvangirai?
We want to see a setting up of a transitional authority, which is on the basis of the 29th of March elections, which we believe were credible, legitimate, and reflected the wills of the people of Zimbabwe. In respect of Robert Mugabe, there is a general consensus beyond my organization and within Zimbabwe itself that Robert Mugabe has had his time, he has nothing new to offer, and if anything, his involvement could be an impediment to the renewal of the democratic spirit in Zimbabwe. But we are saying that Mugabe is not going to be thrown away. We are only asking him to step up into a statesman, you know, at this critical time of our country. We'll give him the due recognition as a freedom fighter, and I think every effort will be made to ensure that his status at least is respected in some way.
Steve Morrison, last word before the break here in about 15 seconds. Do you see an inevitable endgame for Mugabe as volatile and dangerous?
Oh, yes. I mean, we're entering the endgame right now. Mugabe cannot hold on to power for much longer. This is not, he's creating a Burma-like security regime that will repress its own people, but it's not sustainable in the same way that Burma has been sustainable for the last 18 years. So we've got to be looking beyond Mugabe. We should be looking for the ways to build a consensus that he must go. That's the first precondition for any way out of this crisis.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about Zimbabwe's strongman, Robert Mugabe, and what should be done about him. We're speaking this hour with Steve Morrison of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Promise Mukwananzi, former head of the Zimbabwe National Students Union and an exiled activist. I'd like to add one more voice to our conversation here. Joining me in the studio is Shandi Mawoko Matanda. He's a minister and a graduate student at Boston University, whose research focuses on churches in Zimbabwe. Shandi grew up there. He's not been back since 2000, but some of his family remains there. Shandi, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder what you think when you hear the discussion about what's going on in Zimbabwe. You grew up there. I know you have fond memories of your childhood there. What do you make of all this?
I have both fond memories of Zimbabwe, but also what is happening in Zimbabwe is nothing new in my memory as well, because my family was also involved in some political activity during the liberation struggle and shortly after independence, and we did experience similar to what people in Zimbabwe are experiencing right now of the intimidation and the detainment, where my family, my brother was beaten up by youth militia, my father was detained by the central intelligence organizations and accused of trying to build up an army. So I have both memories of fondness and sadness, recognizing that what's happening is nothing new.
You recall several instances when church meetings were mistaken for political meetings and the ramifications of that. Are there any positive things going on? I know that there's a movement for churches to really become involved in Zimbabwe.
There are. I keep in touch with some leadership in Zimbabwe, particularly at one of the universities there, and they keep me apprised on what the churches are doing. And most of what the churches are doing presently is trying to meet the human need. There is tremendous human suffering right now. People are struggling for basic survival. And churches right now are trying to address both the political violence as well as the economic decline. So they're trying to feed people who are hungry, which is not just the political victims, but the whole country. And then at the same time, trying to address and minister to people who are suffering from the political violence. There are thousands of people who have been displaced, have become homeless, are going to bed hungry, and the churches is feeling very overwhelmed with this crisis.
I know you have family still there. Are you hopeful about a future in Zimbabwe that's different from what we see now?
Yes, I am hopeful. I remain hopeful for a future in Zimbabwe. I wouldn't be in ministry if I did not have hope. I do believe that Mugabe's regime will come to an end, and I have the confidence that the churches will play an integral role in that. The churches have had a history of being able to mobilize people, educate people about the issues that are affecting the country, and being able to get them to rally together and proclaiming a united voice for hope and justice in the country.
Shandi, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll come back to you in a moment. I'd like to go to some of our callers who are lined up here, ready to join our conversation. Nashville, Tennessee is where we go first, to Abduli. He's calling there. Welcome to the program. Line's dead. Bruce is calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. Bruce, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
the fact of what we need to know, Steve Morrison is absolutely right, and Heidi Hollins has some very good points to make. But what we really need to understand is that the connection, and we need, Condoleezza Rice is also correct in saying that we need to take this matter to the United Nations Security Council. But what we really need to understand is that this whole situation dates from the 1960s, when it was to have been discussion and independence for Southern Rhodesia, which was what Zimbabwe's name was prior to 1980,
mm-hmm.
Was to have been on the agenda, the first bilateral meeting between John Kennedy and Alec Douglas Hume, the Scot who was the new British Prime Minister at that time. And that never occurred, as we know. And we're going on as a consequence from everything from there. Dean Rusk then met Douglas Hume in mid-December 1963 in London, and there were green lights that started getting passed between Southern Africa, Britain, and the United States. And there's a 14-year period. There was a unilateral declaration. We're about to celebrate the 232nd anniversary of our own unilateral declaration of independence from Britain. And in 1965, Rhodesia, 5% regime, voting on an A roll. There are two rolls of voters, A roll and B roll. B roll.
There's a lot of history here. I hear it, and we would love to get through it all. I turn to Steve Morrison on some of Bruce's points, however, to say, what's the UN responsibility in all this, Steve?
I think the UN has a very special responsibility, particularly the Security Council here, given that SADC, the Southern African Development Community, and AU, African Union, are both having great trouble. They don't have an internal consensus to be able to operate, and this has become an international issue. And so the Security Council does have a role here in pushing to keep a spotlight on, to put an arms embargo on, and to begin to put targeted sanctions against Mugabe and his inner circle, the security chiefs in particular, and to make it much more uncomfortable for these guys to think that they can persevere and survive. They have the ability to stigmatize and out. They have the potential to begin to declassify information around the various schemes that are involving the export of capital out of Zimbabwe by the inner circle. So the Security Council is very well positioned to help to move Zimbabwe beyond Mugabe. They are divided. There are the South Africans on the Security Council, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indonesians are opposing sanctions. But that does not mean that you can't, on a daily and weekly basis, continue to bring these issues up and force some sort of vote on them.
Mm. Steve Morrison, thank you. Back to the phones now. Azurage is calling from Boston. Welcome to the program.
Hey, hi, my name is Rage. Thank you for allowing me to air my views. My biggest question is there are very few African leaders who have retired peacefully and enjoying life after retirement in Africa, and suddenly Mugabe falls under this, and he's 85 years old. He's definitely frightened. Young leaders are coming to take over,
yeah,
and with no regard to his retirement life. And all he's doing is revenging and trying to bring up the past to bear in all this. And my question is for the opposition, if anybody is here, what will it take for them to negotiate like the Kenyans have done, like the opposition in Kenya, and actually share power with Mugabe and maybe help him exit peacefully.
Thank you, Azurage. Promise, let me turn that to you. What kind of difference do you think the opposition can really have?
Obviously, the main concern would be the situation of the rule of law, the immediate halt of the violence in the country, and the commitment from the ruling party that they will be negotiating in earnest and with a view to finding a permanent solution to the problems which the country are facing. But as it stands now, it doesn't seem that there is that commitment from the government, there is that sincerity. And so until those things are on the table, and also the fact that the negotiations would have to be based on the 29th of March elections, which have been more credible and more reflective of the general will of the people of Zimbabwe. I would say my emphasis on that as well.
Shandi, Mugabe says he's open to dialogue. Back to the caller's point, what can the opposition do? Will they have a voice?
I am a bit weary about unity governments myself, because I tend to see them as a strategy for the oppressing party to co-opt the opposition. And this happened in Zimbabwe with Joshua Nkomo of the Zimbabwe African People's Union when he was co-opted by Mugabe, and it's been happening ever since. So I do not see that a unity government with Mugabe still having a voice is going to be a credible unit government.
Sophie is on the line now from Boston, Massachusetts. Sophie, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I just want to say that African leaders in general are a clique, and voices of reason seldom get listened to. And one thing that people of the world have to realize is that Thabo Mbeki seems not to have the interests of Zimbabweans at heart. And I believe that he's hoodwinking the world, and that the sooner that he's removed as the chief mediator on Zimbabwe, the better for all of us. I'm actually from Zimbabwe. Mm. Mugabe seems to have a hold on Thabo Mbeki that really boggles the mind. And my message to President Mbeki is shame on you.
Mm. Sophie, thank you. Steve Morrison, what is the role of South African President Mbeki at this point?
Well, he remains in the lead. As the lead mediator appointed by SADC to do that, although it's very interesting that the African Union in its statement yesterday did not endorse him. It omitted any reference to his role. It simply said it endorsed a continued SADC role, and that, I think, implied that from the AU leadership, that was reflective of the criticism that he's come under. He's been regarded as a wholesale failure in the mediation effort that was put on his desk over a year ago by SADC. And I think that his performance in this period, which has basically played directly into Mugabe's hands, is going to turn out to be, along with his performance on HIV/AIDS, to the hallmark of his tenure, which is very regrettable because he came into power with high expectations for his performance.
Steve, thanks. The caller brought up the point of Mugabe not having the interest of his people at heart, and I pick up on that because there were really high hopes for Mugabe when he came to power in 1980. He was an astute scholar, the political brains behind this new government that had gained independence from Britain, and for a time the country was really prospering economically. And I wonder, Shandi, when did things take a downturn?
Things in my mind started taking a downturn in the late 80s when the IMF programs that were being instituted in Zimbabwe started failing, the structural adjustment programs. I think Mugabe had some good intentions to try to build up the country, and he was successful, but also his concern to remain in power became an impediment in trying to progress the country.
Back to the phones now. Abdullah is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Chen.
Hi.
I think there is a hypocrisy, and United States government helps dictators in Africa, warlords like Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, Millet Senawu of Ethiopia, even Somalian warlords. How can they sanction Mugabe when they help warlords and dictators who are killing civilians
in other places
last 20 years.
I hear what you're saying. I'll turn that to Steve Morrison. What about that? Are we picking on Mugabe in this region?
I don't know how you can make the argument that we're picking on this guy. He's destroyed his economy. He's repressing his own people. He's engaging in terroristic forms of violence. Yes, there's plenty of hypocrisy in terms of the West's engagement in this region. There's plenty of hypocrisy among African leaders whose records are oftentimes not particularly encouraging. But let's keep our sights on the reality that Zimbabwe is the defining crisis today in Southern Africa. There is no denying that today. And I think there's an admission of that, an open admission of that, both within the Security Council and international media, as well as within SADC and the AU. The question now is, how do you move Zimbabwe into some sort of post-Mugabe future that's not going to be more violent and chaotic than it is today?
Mm. One more call. Ashibu is in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jen.
Hello.
My comment is the Zimbabwean election is, the outcome of Zimbabwean election is not new thing. It's always is Africa, same thing always has happened. If you look back Ethiopia in 2005 election, Zenawi, Ethiopian Prime Minister, he get away with it. So why not of Mugabe? Because by the time nobody say anything, Zenawi, he lost election and he did same thing like Mugabe. Now, Mugabe, he did same thing. I think the problem is the European and Americans, I don't think they have a moral ground to say Mugabe, he did wrong.
Same issues in a lot of places. Ashubi, I hear what you're saying. I have about a minute left. I want to turn to our Zimbabweans who are with us this hour, Promise and Shandi. Simple question, do you hope to go back? Do you hope to return to the homeland of your youth? Shandi, you first.
Yes, absolutely, I do. My calling to ministry, I believe, will entail giving back to the country that gave me so much and ministering to the people who I still have great love for. And what is happening is grieving me terribly.
Promise, you have the last word.
Yeah, certainly if it wasn't for Mugabe, I wouldn't be out of the country anyway. So my heart is still with the country, and I cannot wait to go back to the country as soon as Mugabe has been dealt with.
Promise Mukwananzi in Belgium today. I so much appreciate your time. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Shandi Mawoko Mantanda, great to have you with us today, too. Thank you and good luck.
Thank you very much.
Steve Morrison, appreciate your time, Director of Africa Program at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you, Jen.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.